Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with a cybersecurity expert about the recent ransomware attack on Columbus City Hall and how you can protect yourself from fraud. Also, with students heading back into the classroom, Jay will chat with an expert about mental health challenges and solutions for teachers. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up, on Columbus Perspective, here's Jay Fox.
The city of Columbus is dealing with the aftermath of a ransomware attack. Receta, an international ransomware group, has listed stolen Columbus City data for sale on its dark website. In total, the group stole more than 6.5 terabytes worth of information. The price tag? 30 Bitcoin or $1.9 million. Joining us now is Daniel Maldette, a local cybersecurity expert with CMIT Solutions. Daniel, thanks for being with us today. Let's start at the beginning. What is ransomware?
Sure, Jay. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you. Ransomware is malicious software, sometimes referred to as malware. And ransomware, when it gets on a computer or a network, will encrypt critical data. And once that data is encrypted and the business has no longer access to it, then the hackers will ask for a ransom to decrypt the data and return it back to them.
So how does something like this get downloaded in the first place?
Well, there are a few different ways that this malware can get downloaded. One of the most frequent ways is through a phishing email. So a user or an employee of a company may receive a phishing email and not realizing that it is malicious, they may believe that that email is coming from a legitimate source. They may click on a link or they may download a file and not realize that that file is actually malware or will install malware. So in the city's case, there was a user. We don't know if it was a city employee. Mayor Ginther said downloaded what they thought was a PDF file, when in fact it was the malware that got installed on the city's network.
So how would they realize that this has happened? Is it as simple as trying to access a file and being locked out?
Sometimes it's not that easy to tell that this is actually happening, because hackers, once they get access to a network, want to find where that critical data is so they can be successful in having that business or the city pay the ransom. So sometimes we're finding a malware can be on a computer or it can be on a network for weeks or even months before anything happens, before there's even the knowledge that this malware is existing. That's why it's important to have really strong cybersecurity tools that can detect this early on. But it is a very difficult thing to detect, and hackers are always looking at ways to evade the tools that exist. Sometimes the only way that we know that it's happening is when the ransom note shows up on a computer.
So why would they choose a city instead of a major corporation like a bank or an insurance company or maybe like AEP, for example?
Well, the way I look at it is the city is a business, and I think we just look at this as one type of business that might be out there. We know that large corporations are being targeted. We know that the electrical grid is being targeted, and infrastructure, and small businesses as well. So I think the city could be targeted and was targeted because of a few things. One could be they have the funds to pay a ransom. One is they have a lot of critical data. So The hackers through malware, you know, are going to try to find that data. In this case, they did. And the other is the city has a lot of critical infrastructure. So emergency services, electrical services, and other things that hackers could target and not only impact the city employees and the city itself, but then the residents. So there's a lot to gain by hackers in targeting a city.
When you think about paying ransom, you're not dealing with somebody that you know. So A, how do you know if you should pay? How do you know who you're paying? And what's to stop them from not giving back what they said they would give, even if you do pay?
Well, those are all great questions, Jay. And there's really not good answers to some of those, because we may not know who is responsible for the attack unless they reveal it. Most of these payments are in cryptocurrency, so they're not really traceable. And most of the attacks come from outside this country. So we can't really enforce or go after these people very easily. So whether you pay or not, the general advice is to not pay a ransom because it enables the hackers to continue their work. Statistics show that right now, cybersecurity crime has the third highest GDP behind the United States and China. So it's a huge business. So like I said, the general advice is to not pay a ransom. We know that businesses continue to do that because they need to get back up and operating, and they may not be prepared for such an attack. Even some states these days are enacting some laws to prevent state agencies from communicating with attackers regarding ransom. So
what's the
really
risk?
Not a clear answer to some of those questions.
What's the risk to the city of Columbus if they don't pay?
The risk to the city of Columbus if they don't pay is they may not get access to that critical data. Residia has said that they've have information on employee username and passwords, that they have downloaded video footage, and that they have downloaded full server information. So the city has told us that they stopped this attack before the encryption happened. And if that's the case, then the city does have the ability to access their data. But Residia also downloaded that information beforehand. So that's what they're selling in the dark web. And the risk to the city and the employees is once that information gets out, we already know that some police officers have their personal bank accounts attacked, and we don't know if that's necessarily related to this, but this type of activity could go on for years.
So could the city have done anything different to prevent this from happening?
I feel like there's no way to prevent something like this from happening. In our world, we talk about it's not if, but when, regarding any business getting some type of attack. The best thing is to be prepared. The city may have been able to help prevent this if they would have maybe better educated the employees through cyber training, if they would have had more robust tools in place. The city has said that they have put those tools in place now. But again, preventing is probably not something to really think about because this can always happen. The best scenario could be to be prepared and to be prepared to recover in the event of an attack.
So how likely is this to happen again? And let's just use a hypothetical. If they can hack a city, can they hack the Pentagon?
Good question. The hackers have, you know, have attacked a lot of different organizations, even the ones that manufacture and supply the tools to protect the businesses. So it's hard to say that they can't find a way to attack any business. They're typically going to go for the low-hanging fruit. So a lot of businesses, particularly smaller ones, are not really thinking about this in that way and are not using the tools to protect themselves. So while any business could potentially get hacked, there are some that are more prone to that.
Daniel Maldet is a cybersecurity expert here in Columbus with a company called CMIT Solutions. We thank you very much for weighing in on what happened in the city of Columbus and educating us on ransomware. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
It is estimated that there are almost 110,000 students in Columbus and vicinity. Add to that another 60,000 at Ohio State University and other nearby colleges. As students start the new school year, a new poll from the American Psychiatric Association shows Americans are supportive of mental health education and the importance of school staff participating in mental health trainings. In fact, 84% of Americans believe school staff plays a crucial role in identifying signs of mental health issues in students, but here's the rub. Less than half, 45%, believe most school staff have been trained in identifying these concerns. Raul Andrews Jr. is the executive director of the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, and we thank you for speaking with us today. Why has it taken so long for mental health to come to the forefront of our attention when it comes to student wellness?
I want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to come forward. The APA Foundation stands upon a premise that there is no health without mental health. And so the quick answer to your question, Jay, is that for too many centuries, we have not prioritized our mental health and well-being equally with the way we prioritize our physical health. And so because of that lack of prioritization, it's taken longer than it should have.
There are a lot of schools that have wrap counseling programs, but we hear throughout Central Ohio that there is a shortage of mental health counselors in schools. Why has that been the case?
Well, some of it is about education, some of it is about time, and some of it is about people's choices of what type of professions they want to promote. And again, because we haven't prioritized mental health, we haven't prioritized actually directing our advancing students into looking at these careers. The bright light is that because of the negatives around the pandemic and other things, mental health is at the forefront. It probably is at the forefront for the foreseeable future. And so we do see an increase in interest in people pursuing these types of careers in mental health counseling and support. We also see it at the medical school level, where more medical students are looking at psychiatry as a profession. But we can't wait until training is over, Jay. And that's why I'm pleased to tell you and your listening audience that the APA Foundation has secured a federal grant to provide some non-medical training around mental health services and support to our K-12 students nationwide. It's called Notice Talk Act at School. We can do that at no cost to the school and no cost to the parent for less than 3 hours per session.
Now, I've taken mental health first aid myself. And I know that in school, behavioral issues have always been the case and will continue to persist. But now we're dealing with understanding anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and things that happen outside the school that impact the student's daily life in the school. To what degree does the Notice Talk Act program address the specificity of those issues?
So one of the things that we look at Notice Talk Act at school, and we're glad to have the federal grant and grateful for it, is that we look at it as the stop, drop, and roll, Jay, for mental health services support by school staff right now. And when I say stop, drop, and roll, most of your listening audience knows that that didn't turn anybody into a first responder. But they were better equipped to help somebody if there was an emergency related to flame retardation with a fire. So here with Notice Talk Act at school, what we're talking about is if I'm a school teacher, if I'm a counselor, if I'm a cafeteria worker or a bus driver, and if I see something, what do I do when I notice the signs and symptoms of student distress? And then how can I engage in the talk in a courageous and comfortable conversation with that student versus a difficult conversation to see what might really be going on? And then finally, if I get in that conversation, I got to have ready at my disposal some non-medical tools, tips, and resources to try to get these young scholars some help if they need it. And so that's what we believe can happen, is that even if you've taken mental health first aid, and we're not against that, anything we can do to get a little bit better to deal with new challenges post-pandemic, we strongly encourage it, and we strongly encourage that people go to apaf.org/schools, and just take a look at it and see whether or not this is the kind of resource that could help our students and our school community right now.
Now, does this also help with identifying undiagnosed attention deficit disorders?
So I talked to my doctors, and what they've told me is this is not a diagnostic tool. All you're going to be able to do is notice signs and symptoms, and that might lead to referring somebody to a physician to get a diagnosis. But what we're going to be seeing, Jay, is looking for mood changes that are atypical. We're going to be looking for symptoms of withdrawal. The person who loved their fall sport, football, now all of a sudden wants to quit or is not engaging. The person who was in drama no longer wants to be there. The person who's been a high-performing student all of a sudden seems withdrawn, even in the early days of a new academic year. When these things are happening, a lot of times our school staff, according to our poll, you know, over 4 out of 5 Americans think school staff have to play a role. But as you told your audience, only 45% believe that the whole school staff is being brought up to speed about what's really going on and how they can be helpful. And we know, and we thank our educators because we know they want to be helpful.
Do urban areas such as Columbus, Ohio, have greater risk for mental health issues in students, or is it the same regardless of where you are?
So I don't think there is a zip code issue here, Jay, and so it's not really an urban, suburban, or rural. The challenge in a lot of our urban school settings is that you do have a larger student population more times than others, and so it might be more difficult for the school cafeteria worker or the coach or the principal or the homeroom teacher in a bigger school to notice when there are signs of distress because they're dealing with so many other issues and so many other students. In a smaller school setting where the one-to-one ratio might be smaller, doesn't mean we don't have distress, but it might be easier to see that Raul is more easily irritated this year than he seemed to be last year. And I wonder what's happening with Raul. And we can have those easier one-to-one conversations. But what Notice Talk Act tries to do is get some help when we're at that point of seeing that there's something that seems atypical.
Is there any liability for the teachers in this program, or is that something that's covered by the schools?
So, again, because this isn't a diagnostic tool, nobody has told us that there's any liability for the school employing it any more than there would have been liability for the school to employ other training programs like mental health first aid that you mentioned. You know, the difference is it doesn't cost the school anything. The difference is it doesn't cost parents anything. The difference is it only takes 2 to 2.5 hours to get some training. And this is one of the reasons, Jay, why we've been strongly encouraged to focus on the adults, not the children. Yes, if we were directly working with students in the program, there might be other risk factors to APA Foundation or teachers. But because we're adults talking to adults about the issues that are happening in school, we think they're better equipped to understand context and nuance. And when they have context and nuance, what ends up happening is one of two things. You either say, we want this training, we're going to go to apaf.org/schools, and we want to do a big school training. Or, on the flip side, we want to do a train-the-trainer model to further reduce any risk, because Mr. J is going to teach Mr. J's school after he learns the program from APA Foundation, not some outsider coming in trying to change how the school does some things. And we want it to be comfortable for the faculty and staff as well.
Mental health training for teachers, a necessity in this day and age. We want to thank Raul Andrews Jr., the Executive Director of the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
On the campaign trail, Vice President Kamala Harris is now joining former President Donald Trump in calling for no taxes on tips. The vice president made the campaign promise during a rally in Nevada. Trump first made the promise in June. This comes as one Republican lawmaker in Ohio is now looking to do the same for the Buckeye State. State Representative Jay Edwards introduced House Bill 643 a few weeks ago after Trump's announcement. The placeholder bill is just one sentence long, saying the General Assembly declares its intent to exempt tips and gratuities from income tax. The goal is to expand the bill's language and the details when it gets into committee. Edwards says the measure will help tipped workers get by.
When you're dealing with service workers in this state, people that are waiting on you at a restaurant, a lot of times those younger men and women or older men and women are working two or three jobs. They're trying to make ends meet. They're trying to pay their rent.
Edwards says right now he doesn't know how much the measure would cost the state in lost income tax revenue if it gets approved, but he does expect that amount to be relatively small. He says the Legislative Service Commission is working to figure that figure out.
Welcome to Verify This. We know it can be hard to spot misinformation. That's why we're here. We answer your questions and fact-check viral claims so you know what's true and what's false. I'm your host, Ariande Till.
I've spoken to the biggest crowds. Nobody's spoken to crowds bigger than me.
President Trump has boasted that his rallies are larger than his political opponents, and possibly even those than the late Martin Luther King Jr. Now he's claiming photos showing a large turnout at a Harris Walls rally are AI generated. Here's what we found. These images show a crowd of supporters for Vice President Kamala Harris and her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, at an airport hangar in Michigan ahead of their August 7th rally. In an August 11th post on Truth Social, former President Donald Trump shared these images and claimed those crowds didn't exist. He said nobody was there and that Harris has been using AI to fake images at her rallies to make it seem like there is a larger audience. Other posts claim the reflection on the plane and the lack of call letters on the tail of the plane are also evidence that the images were manipulated. But using these sources, we can verify there's no evidence to back those claims up. These photos I showed you were taken by the Associated Press. The event was also live-streamed by multiple local and national news outlets, and attendees shared similar images of the crowd from multiple angles. Michigan Live, a local news outlet, estimated that 15,000 people filled the hangar and that attendees spilled out onto the tarmac. And for security purposes, Air Force Two, the vice president's plane, isn't marked with call letters. So we can verify that Trump's claim about the fake crowds at Harris's Michigan rally is false. Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz's campaign for the White House is in full swing. Harris claimed Trump will end Social Security if elected again, and some of you had questions about that. Casey Decker clears up the confusion.
Vice President Kamala Harris has hit the campaign trail, holding regular rallies all across the country. Some of you have been asking about a claim she's repeatedly made during her speeches about former President Donald Trump's agenda if he wins.
Just look at his Project 2025 agenda. I take it you've seen it. Project 2025 is a plan to weaken the middle class. Be clear. And Donald Trump intends to cut Social Security.
Harris's new running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, made a similar claim in his first speech with the campaign.
He'll gut Social Security and Medicare.
So let's verify. Does Donald Trump currently support cutting Social Security? Our sources, statements made by Trump, Agenda 47, and Project 2025. Harris's claim was based on Project 2025, a proposal to enact hundreds of conservative policies if Republicans take back the White House. The project is not directly connected to Trump, though its proposals were largely written by members of his administration. It does not propose cutting or making any changes to Social Security. We searched through all of Project 2025's 900-plus pages, and Social Security is barely mentioned. Trump has his own policy plan called Agenda 47, and this one does mention Social Security. It says, quote, "Under no circumstances should Republicans vote to cut a single penny from Social Security." And the official Republican Party platform adopted at the convention calls for the GOP to, quote, "fight for and protect Social Security with no cuts, including no changes to the retirement age." Trump has also repeatedly posted about the issue on social media, like this post, reading, quote, "We are going to shore up Social Security, making it much stronger, but with no cuts." So we can verify, no, Trump does not currently support cutting Social Security. So where did the claims come from? The Harris campaign in the past has pointed to an interview Trump did with CNBC, during which he said, quote, "There is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting." But he quickly walked back that statement, saying in a later interview with Breitbart that he meant cutting back on fraud. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz's military record has come under scrutiny recently, with J.D. Vance calling the timing of his retirement from the military shameful. Here's what we can verify about Walz's military career.
I'm retired Command Sergeant Major Tom Behrens from Brewster, Minnesota.
Behrens, who served with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz in the Minnesota National Guard, accused him in 2018, and again in this 2022 news conference, of bailing on his troops before they got sent to Iraq. He says their unit knew as early as March of 2005 that they would be deployed, yet Walz chose to retire first.
He knew damn well what was going to be going on.
Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance also criticized Walz's military record.
When Tim Walz was asked by his country to go to Iraq, you know what he did? He dropped out of the army and allowed his unit to go without him.
Other colleagues who served with Walz, including retired Command Sergeant Major Joseph Eustis, defended him.
He did his duty.
Adding that Walz spoke to him about his retirement ahead of time.
It's about being honest about his service, and he did his service as well as anyone did.
Dozens of you have asked us to verify claims about Tim Walz's military service record. Here's what we can verify using these sources. Walz served in the National Guard for nearly 24 years, from April of 1981 to May of 2005. In February 2005, Walz filed paperwork to run for Congress. In March 2005, while he was running for Congress, the Guard announced a possible partial mobilization of roughly 2,000 troops from the Minnesota National Guard. Despite the possible deployment, Walz said at the time that he did not plan to drop out of his race for Congress, adding, "I am dedicated to serving my country to the best of my ability, whether that's in Washington, D.C. or in Iraq." In May 2005, Walz retired from the National Guard. His separation record confirms he did so honorably. Nearly 2 months later, in July, Walz's unit received an alert order for mobilization to Iraq. The unit mobilized in October and eventually deployed in March of 2006. In 2022, Walz commented on concerns about the timing of his retirement.
We all do what we can. I'm proud I did 24 years. I have an honorable record.
So it's true that Walz retired from the National Guard before his unit deployed to Iraq. But there's no evidence he retired in order to avoid the deployment, as some people have claimed. We're also looking into questions about J.D. Vance's military history. Plus, could Cash App users really be owed thousands of dollars from the company? Welcome back to Verify This.
When Tim Walz was asked by his country to go to Iraq, you know what he did? He dropped out of the army and allowed his unit to go without him.
After Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance accused his opponent, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, of stolen valor, many Verify viewers asked us questions about Vance's military service history. Verify digital reporter Megan Lowe joins us with those answers.
So, Megan, did Vance serve in the military?
He did. Vance did serve in the Marine Corps for nearly 4 years, and he was in a public relations role there. He enlisted after graduating from high school in 2003, and the Marines told us that he served from September of that year to September 2007.
And you said that his role was focused on public relations, right? So what did that entail exactly?
Well, Vance served as what's called a combat correspondent, and that's essentially a military journalist. In that role, he said he would sometimes escort civilian press, but he mainly took photos and wrote stories about Marines and what they were doing. And we even found some articles that he published in 2005 and 2006.
In that role with the Marines, Megan, was Vance ever deployed overseas?
He was. The Marine Corps told us that Vance was deployed to Iraq for about 6 months, and that deployment started in August 2005. But he didn't experience combat himself, and that's something he has reiterated at least a few times over the years. He told reporters earlier this month that he did serve in a combat zone, but he, quote, never said that I saw a firefight myself, end quote. And he also wrote about his time in Iraq in his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, which you may know was made into a Netflix movie. He said in that book that he was, quote, lucky to escape any real fighting, end quote, while he was in Iraq.
Megan, thank you for looking into this. And I know people can read more about your story on verifythis.com.
Thanks so much for having me, Arianne.
Concerns that a new website can cancel other people's voter registration in Georgia without their consent are swirling on social media. We verify whether the claims are true. Georgia has more than 8 million registered voters, including 900,000 classified as inactive. Those are people who have moved out of state or not voted in a recent election. Historically, if someone wanted to cancel a Georgia voter registration, they'd have to do it by mail or email. But recently, several people online claimed that Georgia launched a new website that allows anyone in the state to cancel not just their own registration, but other people's too, and without their consent, sparking concerns about how this could impact the upcoming election. So let's verify. Did Georgia launch a voter registration cancellation web portal? On July 29th, Georgia election officials launched a web portal that allows people in the state to cancel their voter registration online. Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, says digitizing the process is intended to help keep Georgia's voter registration database up to date without having to rely on postcards being sent and returned by an increasingly inefficient postal system. To request a cancellation, you must enter a voter's first initial, last name, the county in which they're registered to vote, their date of birth, and either a driver's license number or a partial social security number. That request triggers a notification on the state's computer system to remove the voter from the rolls. So, we can verify, claims that Georgia launched a voter registration cancellation web portal are true. And as critics fear, anyone who has all of their required information could cancel someone else's registration without their consent. Although Raffensperger's office said that the portal creates a trail for identifying any malicious individuals who would attempt to cancel voter registrations without the voter's knowledge.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State. Courtesy of 10TV.
Now to the latest chapter in what's been called the largest scandal in Ohio history, the First Energy $60 million bribery scheme. The energy company announced it reached a deal with state prosecutors to avoid criminal charges. First Energy will pay $20 million to resolve its role in the House Bill 6 scandal. The Attorney General's office says First Energy is a different company than it was 5 years ago and has been cooperating with investigators. Meanwhile, a Democratic lawmaker says the $20 million payment just isn't big enough.
Under the agreement, First Energy will pay the Ohio Attorney General's office $19.5 million and set aside $500,000 to pay for unspecified remediation commitments by the company. The agreement also requires the company to cooperate with ongoing investigations by the State Attorney General and Summit County Prosecutor's offices. That includes cases against former First Energy CEO Chuck Jones and former Senior Vice President Michael Dowling, who were charged in the case in April. They both deny wrongdoing. wrongdoing. Attorney General's Office spokesperson Steve Irwin said in a statement, the corporation has undertaken and continues to undergo reforms to strengthen its internal ethics programs, to increase transparency and promote reporting of questionable conduct by its employees and leadership. Democratic State Representative Sean Brennan says he's pleased the deal will allow the investigations to move forward and that FirstEnergy has to cooperate.
I understand, just like everybody does, that if you don't punish bad behavior, it'll continue to fester. And we've just got to send a message to, you know, to these corporations that corruption has no place in Ohio.
According to the agreement document, the $19.5 million being paid to the Ohio Attorney General's office will go to a non-energy charitable organization to be determined by the AG's office and to reimburse costs of the investigation. Democratic State Senator Kent Smith calls the sum paltry.
$20 million is 2% of their profit, and for 1 year, and it's going to a charity of the AG's office's choosing. This is, again, the amount is too small and it's going the wrong direction.
Senator Smith told me he plans to send a letter to the Attorney General's office pushing them to renegotiate the $20 million payment to a much higher amount. I also reached out to Republican leadership about the agreement. They had no comment. FirstEnergy's president did release a statement saying they are pleased to reach a resolution with prosecutors that, quote, recognizes the substantial actions FirstEnergy has taken to establish a highly effective compliance program and instill a culture of ethics and integrity at every level of the organization. While Jones and Dowling have both denied any wrongdoing, a former House Speaker Larry Householder is serving 20 years in federal prison for his role. Plus, lobbyist Matt Borges, a former chair of the Ohio Republican Party, is serving 5 years. Sam Randazzo was the former public utilities chairman. He pleaded not guilty to both federal and state charges before dying by suicide in April. If you're struggling with thoughts of suicide, you can call 988. Help is available for free 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots.
Woot, woot.
And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Woot.
Maybe you've made a donation there. Maybe you've gone thrift shopping there. Maybe you or someone you know has worked there or gotten job training there. I'm talking about Goodwill. In a nutshell, the nonprofit sells donated clothing, furniture, household items, and other goods to give people job opportunities and training. And Goodwill Columbus has been doing that for a long time, since 1939. It's now marking its 85th year. Goodwill Columbus recently opened a brand new location in Grove City that has all of the organization's services in one place. Those are retail, donation, job training, and adult day services. It's the only Goodwill Columbus location to have all four. Joining me now to talk about the 85th anniversary and the growth of Goodwill Columbus is CEO Ryan Burgess. Ryan, thanks for being here today.
Doug, good to see you.
So first of all, you know, with this new facility, how were you able to make it work that you could have all four of those key service areas in one place?
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to join you this morning. This store, the way we've designed it, was intentional because, as you said, most folks probably know us as a thrift store or a thrift operator, but most people don't understand all the programs and services that we offer in our community. So by designing this store with four of our functions that we offer, it allows people to see all that we can offer to their community. So in this store in Grove City, right on Stringtown Road, we have a store. We have a donation center in the back, but right next to it, we have a job training center and adult day services hub. So now when our shoppers or donors come in, they can actually see the people who benefit from their patronage in our stores.
What kind of job training is being offered there?
Yeah, so at all of our job training centers, we have four job training centers around the county. They have access to career coaches. Individuals have access to career coaches who can help them better understand a pathway that might be successful for them. So first of all of our services are free. The access to the career coaches are free. But then specifically, we have three career pathways, IT, healthcare, and what we call infrastructure pathways. So we offer basic digital skills training, IT certification programs. We have an entry level healthcare certification program. And then within infrastructure, we offer the CDL. We've partnered with a firm to offer this truck driving license, as well as we're just about to launch a broadband technician training program.
And part of that is, especially with the, I believe it's the Bryce Road location, you have this program in place that through a partnership with the state to offer training for the broadband industry. And how is that going? How popular has that been? That opened last September.
So they're also, that program is also going to be available to our Grove City location. And we've partnered with a number of folks and organizations around Central Ohio to meet the demand. They estimate that 30,000 broadband technicians are needed to fill the needs that we have to build out our infrastructure and keep up with the rapidly growing Central Ohio population. So we're very excited to offer this program, and it's going well.
Where would those jobs be?
There's a lot of small firms that are growing to offer these services, but then there's also the large communication companies that have needs for those jobs as well.
Ryan Burgess, CEO of Goodwill Columbus, congratulations on 85 years and the recent growth.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you for being here.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State, a new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1, The Fan, and on 1460 AM, ESPN Columbus.